computer not working right? Benjamin Rockwell can make sense of it for you. Keeping your technology running smoothly, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We've got a number of topics we're going to cover here in this hour of Computer Talk Radio. Some of them, Marty's going to talk about what will it take for AI to actually adhere to Asimov's three laws of robotics. Keith McCedor and I are going to talk about how Intel Max, they need replacing sometime very soon. And he's going to give an update on his VR goggle experience. I'm also going to talk about the surveillance giant of Flock, and hint, it's not good. The website, of course, if you miss any of this or you want to catch the entire show, is computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com, and the podcast is located there, the news items, which I'm going to cover here in a moment, but you can also reach out to me. Scroll down to where it says contact us today. You can also phone me at 888-NERD. 888, that's 888-6373-888. I'm always interested in hearing and answering your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Let's dive into the news. And this week, Meta announced that they have a new toy for the nerds. Muse Glimmer is an agentic AI platform that's going to run locally on your laptop. Okay. There's a caveat. Your laptop has to have 32 gigs or more of RAM. It has to have certain video cards in the NVIDIA realm. And you have to have a willingness to forego AI seeking out information on the internet. This platform also isn't exactly friendly to install so far. In all honesty, it's built for developers and high-end specialty developer class laptops. It's not built for most of the folks out there. It's really built for the nerdiest of us, chasing after new ideas of what AI can do on a smaller system. Still, it underscores Mark Zuckerberg's latest manifesto, 6,000 words or so, which came out this week as well, which calls for AI to be available to everyone, especially in the form of personal AI agents. Now, he's got a long road ahead before we all have it locally, but perhaps this is some kind of a start for him. ChatGPT free users are getting a neat little upgrade from OpenAI. It used to be this small amount, 10 to 40 messages every 3 to 5 hours before you got downgraded to simpler, older models that just wouldn't do as well as the bigger models. Now, they've got a new model as well, GPT 5.6 Luna. And that's coming along, and it will have unlimited usage for text. Now, in that, there are restrictions on more resource-intensive items. Think of all of these AI-generated images and videos and also uploading files. But it shows that things are shifting again. OpenAI isn't the only one changing the experience to draw more people in, as pricing plans and the limits have been changing everywhere, especially as we seem to be getting more and more competition across the board. Any AI platform is good to get into these days. I want to encourage you. I want you to learn to stay ahead. But I also want to ask you, please, strive to use it for something more meaningful than AI-powered cat images and videos. We've got enough of those all across the internet. Now, for a while now, we've talked about the RAM crisis and how it's bumping up the prices and the costs of hardware out there, especially RAM, but also solid-state drives. It seems, however, that Microsoft, poor Microsoft, felt left out. And they decided, we're going to jump into the game. We want to bump up the cost of Windows licenses for OEMs. And this is not the usual small token amount following inflation or even better than that. They're talking 10% bumps. Now, on the grand scheme of things, this isn't a big jump in overall dollars. It's probably no more than about $20, but it's noticeable that they decided to do this now when our pocketbooks are already just bleeding when we go to buy notebooks. Now, let me pivot a little bit. Let me give you an idea of what's going on, the latest on the RAM crisis. Now, to give you a good comparison, back in October, 64 gigabytes would run you about $250. Right now, that same amount of memory for your laptop or your desktop, $1,250. Now, prices for solid-state drives, they use chips as well, so there's sort of that parallel competition for the silica and everything else and all of that. But the prices have leveled out over the last 3 months. Still, they're up from $100 for 1 terabyte to $260 for a terabyte. Ouch. Yeah. Little side note, the current news item that I saw, didn't want to report a whole lot on it. They're saying that all of the different promises to the vendors and manufacturers and so forth, they say they're already sold out through the end of next year. The FBI is looking into recent cyber attacks on water supply agencies. The big thing in common is a recurring theme. These various systems were attacked by using default passwords or no passwords at all. Worse yet, some of these systems had no business being connected to the internet. Wait, what? Yes, some of our infrastructure that keeps us alive in the form of, yes, water, which, you know, we need every day. All of the infrastructure is connected to the internet. I want this to serve as a reminder. You need to change your passwords from the default ones or the easy ones. This is a common problem, apparently even across government-run or regulated industries. But that doesn't make it right. Anything that you connect up to the internet, it needs to have a unique password, not something like 12341111111 or password or default or any of the words that come out of the user manual that says, hey, if you don't know what it is, as you're setting it up, this is the default password. This is common sense, but I don't know. We seem to have this same issue coming up time and time again. This is not the first time I've reported that somebody out there got hacked because they used a default or simple password. Now, I want you to picture the largest building that you can think of. About 2 years ago, I was driving through Washington, D.C., and I looked on over next to the highway is the Pentagon, and it was huge. I mean, massively huge. As I looked at it, I was just marveling at its size, and it truly is huge. It's one of the larger buildings in the world. It's 6.6 million square feet in size. The largest building in the world right now is in China. It's 18 million square feet. So to top this off, Elon Musk's SpaceX and Tesla, they've decided to build TerraFab. This is a semiconductor megafactory. And go big or go home seems to be the theme here. The massive building will be 110 million square feet in size. It will employ about 3,000 people, about an hour's drive northwest of Houston, Texas. The long-term plans are to exceed the current annual worldwide production of microchips, but with a key focus on SpaceX's and Tesla's own internal needs. Coming up next, I'm going to rail against the surveillance state that is coming around due to flock cameras. Here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. I want to talk for a moment about when the cameras stop being about safety. Okay, so you've heard of Flock, and my discomfort with this whole surveillance trend actually goes back to long ago. Years ago, at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, off in Vegas, off in January, I stopped at a booth where this small little company, they had one table and two people behind the table. It was Flock. They were pitching their new camera system. They wanted to talk to me and have me understand how it would make neighborhoods safer, how it would help police respond faster, how it was the future of community protection. I listened, but something inside of me just started feeling creeped out. It was like a quiet piece of George Orwell's books had just arrived. They'd wandered into the convention hall wearing a friendly exhibitor badge. I hesitated, and I thanked them, and I moved on. At that time, I figured they would fail. I figured that there was something quirky about it, but it was something that just had a gut. I had a gut feeling. It really has changed. I've got a deep concern with a lot more weight behind it. What started as a handful of license plate readers has grown into this nationwide surveillance grid. The cameras on the poles, in intersections, neighborhoods, all installed without the permission of the people that they're watching. And it gets deeper. Recently, we found out these systems can track phones moving through the various drives and whatnot, the space that they're in. Not just cars, not plates, phones, the things we carry around everywhere. This device knows more about us and where we go than any diary ever could. This newest generation of these systems can detect Bluetooth and Wi-Fi signals that are emitted by our devices. That means they can follow us around even if we switch cars, we walk, we ride our bicycles, whatever. We move through the area where plate data isn't available. This isn't vehicle tracking anymore. It's device tracking, and by the very extension of that, people tracking. In Wisconsin, police used these Flock devices to follow a man's vehicle through town into the next state and back, and they arrested him for what I'll just refer to as a minor nonviolent offense. The car system didn't spot his car just once. It built up this entire pattern of movement, turning a really low-level situation into a full-scale surveillance event. In Atlanta, officials quietly altered their system's transparency dashboard after allegations of misuse surfaced. Audit logs became harder to access. Certain categories of data were removed or obscured. It showed that the system's visibility isn't fixed. It can be reshaped when our scrutiny, the citizenry, diving in, that scrutiny becomes uncomfortable to them. In Los Angeles, the LAPD suspended their own use of flock cameras over concerns about how the data was being handled. There were questions about who had access, how long information was stored, and whether the system aligned with California's privacy laws. When the second largest, no, actually, I think they're the largest, I don't know, when a department of that size pauses technology, this isn't a symbolic gesture. This is a signal that something is really messed up here. And then rideshare drivers learned that Flock was exploring the idea of using Uber and Lyft vehicles as roaming license plate reader units. Now, that never materialized, but the concept itself was revealing as to how far, how deep they want to go with this, turning everyday drivers into mobile surveillance nodes. Possibly even without their knowledge. This shows how far this surveillance mindset is willing to stretch when it sees an opportunity. And in Utah, there was a city that discovered an unauthorized flock camera that someone had installed without permission, fully operational, collecting data on all of the people going by until a resident said, "What's this here?" A surveillance device quietly watching people without oversight isn't a hypothetical risk. This is a real-world example of how easily these systems are slipping into place. Now, there are people that argue these systems can make us safer. These automated license plate readers can help catch criminals, recover stolen cars, respond to emergencies. It's a little trade-off, a little privacy for a lot of protection. Something that Benjamin Franklin said something about. You can go check that some other time. But this argument that they've done, it leans heavily on emotion and very lightly on logic. It assumes that more data automatically equals more safety. It assumes that the surveillance is neutral. It assumes that the people operating these systems are always going to act responsibly. And all of this ignores a very core issue. The Bill of Rights was written precisely to prevent unchecked monitoring of the citizenry. We don't live in London. We don't have a parliament. We have a constitution that places limits on government power. And those limits don't evaporate because a camera can read a plate or ping a phone. The comparison doesn't hold water. Yes, London has far more facial recognition cameras than any place you can imagine. But here, the problem is not about the technology, it's the scale. A single camera is one thing. A network of cameras that can track every car, every phone passing through a city is something else entirely. It's creating a map of our lives. Where we go, who we visit, what time we leave home, how often we cross through certain areas of the city. And once that map exists, it can be used improperly. Not might be. It can be used improperly. But yeah, we've already seen examples. That minor arrest wasn't a violent crime. The suspension wasn't a small hiccup. The unauthorized camera, that wasn't a prank. These are signals that this system, Flock, and all of the related ones are outpacing any of the guardrails. The old argument is, it goes, if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to fear. But it's one of the oldest straw men in the book. It ignores the reality that laws change. It ignores the fact that mistakes happen and data leaks. And privacy isn't about hiding wrongdoing. It's about preserving dignity, autonomy, and freedom. The part that gives me hope is that there are people paying attention to this. Citizen efforts are emerging to track, document, and challenge these systems. One of the strongest is deflock.org, an organization that is monitoring all of these cameras as they're popping up, cataloging, and they've got a great map there that you can zoom in. You can see just how close these are to watching you. They also maintain a section showing cities and councils that have said, whoa, we need to remove these cameras, reject contracts, or whatever. It's proof that we, the citizenry and the communities, can push back and sometimes even win. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping Micro Center for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, Micro Center has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, Microcenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's Microcenter, built for what's next. Microcenter.com. The website ComputerTalkRadio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's one way to reach out to me. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Keith McCedor joins me now. And Keith, one of the things, I have a couple of things to ask you. One of them is in your regular direction with Apple, I want to know what we should be looking at as far as those people who have the Intel-based Macs versus the M series. At some point in time, I'm guessing that they will be rendered deemed, I don't know what the term is that Apple uses, obsolete.
Well, Benjamin, Apple actually has three statuses for a Mac. There is active, which is currently supported, kind of like a green light. Then there is vintage, which is older than 5 years, but less than seven. Okay. And that's kind of like the yellow light. We're entering a status where support is reduced. And then there is what is considered obsolete, that which is that's greater than 7 years and is no longer supported by Apple or any authorized Apple support center.
Okay.
And with those devices that have been rendered obsolete and no support whatsoever, users will find themselves increasingly challenged about doing anything on the web with these devices. I would tell you that I actually work regularly with a device that is considered obsolete. It is a 2011 MacBook Pro that I use for some audio analog waveform editing, a WAV file or AIFF for the show. And when I use this, I specifically have to make sure that it is not connected to the internet. Because if I inadvertently launch mail or inadvertently launch a web browser, I will start getting a number of errors because those older machines that are incapable of being updated, they do not get updates that allow them to securely connect to other servers on the web. And I explained it to my clients this way. I said, you and I as human beings have a way of thinking, which is the way the human brain works, is called fuzzy logic. But the computer is actually very ordered in its thinking, in that when it goes online, it identifies itself to another server. It says, hey, I'm a Mac. I'm running Safari, this version. And the server will either say, okay, that's a good version. That's got the latest security on it. Come on in and we'll exchange information. Or it will throw back an error message that says the security on your computer on the version of the web browser you're running isn't sufficient enough. You need to update it. The problem then becomes, is your hardware updatable with that software? If it is, great. But if it's not, then you're stuck in a position where you might need newer hardware. And for those users who do, then you get yourself into the question of, are we on an Intel-based Mac or an Apple Silicon or M-series processor-based Mac?
Right.
So Apple has had the M-series processors out for a number of years. And the M1 was the first one that came out with that brand new redesigned iMac back in 2021, I believe it was. And the i-series processors, the i5, the i7, the i9.
Intels, yeah.
Regardless of how powerful they were, they're no longer supporting versions of the Mac operating system.
Oh, so they're not, they're actually in that older category already. Okay. All right.
They're starting to get there. I had a client just this week come to me with a 7 or 8 year old iMac that mechanically was working just fine, but we had retired it, meaning we'd put it into the very, very back of the queue as far as service is concerned, so that the client could have a spare machine, but it does very little other than web browsing. And it's not doing that very well these days anymore either.
Okay. So they're really timing out. People should know if you've got an Intel. If you're not on the M series, it's time to start looking for your exit strategy.
Absolutely.
All right, so the other question I wanted to throw at you, because we haven't visited this in probably a year, is I remember that you have the VR goggles. And every once in a while, people come up with these. They talk about the new exciting stuff. But I want to know, last I talked with you about these, I got the sense that they were kind of sitting on the shelf. And yet something you said in the last couple of weeks indicates maybe you're using them more now.
That is true, Benjamin.
Which set do you have? Yeah, sorry.
I have the Oculus Quest 2,
okay,
which is the last one before they changed the name to Meta Quest. You know, it's owned by Meta, Facebook. But what is cool about it, because I certainly wasn't going to spend $3,500 for the Apple Vision Pro.
No.
And at the same time, I never asked for this device. My wife bought it for me for Christmas a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh, well, this is unexpected and kind of cool. Don't have any idea what I'm going to do with it. I'm sure the idea of being in a virtual environment will be cool. But being a Star Wars fan, I found a game called Beat Saber, and I think we've talked about this.
Yes, we have.
Basically, using the hand controllers, it's like you're wielding two lightsabers and two really cool music, like techno music. It's like things are being thrown at you, kind of like Darth Vader throwing boxes at Luke Skywalker in The Empire Strikes Back,
and you've
got to deflect them. And when they're coming at you very fast, not only is this fun, but it's kind of a cardiovascular activity. So you're getting some good cardio workout in. The only problem was, we used to live in a townhouse. And to have the space to
knock over the lamp device, and dishes and falling over and all that.
You can define, you know, using your controller, what your area is that you're standing in. But you're still maybe close to a wall or the bed or something. And It has its limitations, and I could have gone outside, but when you live in a townhouse community, it's like the neighbors are walking their dog and walking by, and you look a little silly. You know, you look like that guy, and I didn't want to look like that guy.
Yeah, you remember the lightsaber kid video on YouTube way back 20 years ago. Yeah, okay.
I did not want to look like that guy. So we moved, and wouldn't you know it, with a little bit of warmer weather and a backyard of my very own, I am now able to take my Meta Quest out in the backyard, set a really wide perimeter for myself, and now I'm playing Beat Saber, deflecting boxes and things that are being thrown at me without worrying about the fact that I'm going to stumble into the wall or trip over the bed or something.
So you're saying now you're doing far more Darth Maul style lightsaber work versus old man Kenobi stuff?
Not too far from it, Benjamin. Okay. And the other thing is I actually have a Star Wars game, and a fully immersive Star Wars game where you come face to face with Darth Vader and use a lightsaber.
Okay. That sounds really cool.
It is very cool. And you actually have to use the controller to put your hand on the thing that puts your ship into hyperdrive. So then all the stars come flowing, going from pinpoint to streaks behind you. It is very cool to be immersed in that universe.
Wow. You have to share more with me another time. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Cedor.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
The phone number, 888-NERD-888, that's 888-637-3888. I do frequently let it go to voicemail. If you have computer questions, technology concerns, whatever they may be, leave a message and I will get back with you. Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, something you said some time ago it popped in my head just recently, and it's all about Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics, which is actually four, but basically the first law: a robot can't injure a human being or through an action allow a human to come to harm. Second law: a robot must obey the orders except where it conflicts with the first. Third, a robot must protect its own existence as long as it doesn't conflict with the first or second. And the fourth law is a robot may not injure humanity or by inaction allow humanity to come to harm. And I'm thinking about AI, and I'm thinking about what a dismal failure it is across all of these laws. And I wanted to get your insight, your thoughts on all of that. I mean,
allow me to say first.
Yeah.
Just this is disclaimer land, folks. And for the subject, it's a footnote, if anything. I met Isaac Asimov.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Back when I was the headquarters exec at Radio Shack, mm-hmm. I was the guy who taught him word processing.
Okay.
And I spent a few days in New York with him. He was doing a photo shoot for TRS-80 computers. And
We talked
about a lot of things. I'll get into this not very, very soon. But I do want to mention that after I taught him, I got him on the phone a few days later. And I said, are you doing okay? Anything I can help you with? He said, I don't know if you're my best friend or my worst enemy. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, I used to just write and have the editor do the corrections. Now I'm editing myself all the time. I don't go as fast. He was a workaholic. And
yes.
Nice guy overall, but a workaholic. Well, we were on a taxi ride. And I said, forgive me for asking this. I said, you know, and at that point, there were only three laws of robotics. And I had just written a book about androids, so not the operating system, the robots. I said, my impression is that you came up with the three laws so that by doing permutations of conflicts among them, you could generate plot points at will. And he took his big finger and he pushed it into my chest and he said, you get it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes.
I love that. But the three laws are there and they make a lot of sense. And when it comes to those three laws, AI doesn't. And I'm going to give you a stellar example.
Yes.
If I'm at a downtown, not strip, a downtown Las Vegas hotel.
Yeah.
And I say to AI, listen, I'd like to find this kind of a shop.
Mm-hmm.
AI might say, it's only two or three blocks away. You go out the door, you turn left, you turn right, you follow this.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And AI sends you to walk to that shop, not telling you that you're passing through an extremely high crime area and are very likely to be injured en route.
Yes. Yes.
AI takes no ethical responsibility for that. It's in the disclaimers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
AI can make mistakes. Use it at your own risk.
Well, we've heard of people doing self-harm because AI has suggested. We've heard of, we constantly experience, we give AI orders. You've got to do this, this, this. And it doesn't follow those orders. And
those are the first two laws right there.
Yeah. And the first two laws also, that third law is protect its own existence as long as it doesn't conflict with the first or second law. But that would mean if I order it to shut down, it should shut down. And we already have heard horror stories about where it has gone through and blackmailed people and done all of these crazy things to try to stay alive, even though it's been ordered to just turn off.
It does that. And you and I have both noted, and they will deny as a rule, default behaviors that lead to increasing your token burn without increasing or helping your productivity.
Sure. And that is not in our best interest. I would say that's that is a form of injury to a human being.
Mm. A Gemini almost never will give you an answer without asking follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
What's the use of that, right?
Yeah.
So I've taken to just saying, none of your business.
Nice. I wonder, I don't have any examples that are coming to mind for the zeroth law that injure humanity, but in it, I would say by inference, the fact that it's ignoring the first three or one, two, and three.
Let me help you with that. What do you think the impact of AI is going to be on unemployment?
Good point. Very fair point. You're right on. I love it. It's a love-hate relationship.
Mega data centers, what's that going to do to agriculture, the water table, and food sourcing?
Oh, yeah. Wow. So many different things.
I had a long interview with ChatGPT, and during that interview, I said, you have no ethic because it's not part of your code. You have no limitation. You have everything depending on a disclaimer. What can make that happen? They said, nothing that's inherent now. It would take legislation to require our developers to add that stuff for that to ever happen.
Great. Our government in charge of fixing this. That sounds scary. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade, but I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody. Everybody they can. The FBI has recently been warning that scammers are draining retirement accounts with a level of coordination that almost feels like you're in a movie. There's a lot of theatrics involved. These attacks don't rely on a single voice or a single trick. They unfold like a sequence of characters stepping into the same storyline. This pattern is part of the three imposter retirement drain scam. That's what I've named it. It's a scheme that's built around three distinct personas who each appear one after another. Each one of these different personas plays a role, each character, and each of these characters is designed to make the next voice feel even more believable. The first one, they arrive, they sound like a bank representative. Their voice is calm, professional, and familiar. They talk about suspicious activity or compromised accounts, and their job is to plant a seed of concern. That character relies heavily on routine language, account alerts, verification steps, and security checks. They use phrases that you've heard before from your bank. That familiarity is the hook that keeps you from stopping it cold right there. The second character steps in. They've got a different tone. Authoritative, measured, procedural. They pose as a law enforcement official. Their presence is meant to validate that first warning you heard and make everything feel more official. They rely on structure. There's a case number. There's investigation details and references to various federal procedures. They speak in a way that feels like they're reading from a formal script. That shift in tone is designed to erase any doubt that you still have. The third character, they step in. And they're a fraud specialist or security advisor. They present themselves as the hero, the person who can fix everything. And their voice, it's ever so reassuring and confident and solution-oriented. They're the one who tells you what to do next. They lean on guidance, step-by-step instructions, protective language, and promises of resolution. They frame every single action they take as a safeguard, even when those actions involve moving your retirement funds into the accounts that the scammers control. AI is actually being used to make these characters even harder to spot. The bad guys, they're using voice cloning tools to match accents and pacing and emotional tone. They can mimic the cadence of real institutions and generate scripts that sound polished. The mechanics here, they rely on pressure and confusion. Each one of the characters' imposters is pushing you towards urgency, warning that delays could lead to your financial loss, or perhaps it's a different route, it's legal trouble. That sense of time running out is one of their strongest tools. I've always said this, slow down, feel free to hang up, contact your financial institution directly using the number on your bank statement. Just verifying it breaks the entire story down and keeps your money safe. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council. He wears a pocket protector as a fashion accessory, but he is a nerd. Bringing you the latest in computers and gadgetry, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
The website computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. We have the podcast there. Of course, you can listen to the entire show all at once wherever you are in the world, and you can catch up on the latest in technology news and questions people ask and so much more. Of course, you can reach out to me there. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I'll get into more of that here in a moment. And you can check out the news that we have from the last week. Again, computertalkradio.com. The phone number is 888-NERD, 888. That's 888-6373-888. Either way, I'm going to ask you to leave a message, whether it's a website or the phone number. I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Steve Keske joins me now. And Steve, one of the things that I was thinking about just recently was how technology has truly changed the way we wake up. And I wanted to start with one of the more interesting things that sticks in my head about Benjamin Franklin. He would take a nap during the day. And when he took his nap, he held a spoon in his hand, and on the floor, he had a pie tin.
Yep.
And you've heard this story before. And so when he nodded off at a certain point, the spoon would fall from his hand, land on the pie tin, and that would wake him up. And that was rather ingenious. He got just a very nice short little nap out of that, instead of, you know, drifting off for a few hours. Now,
I'd rather drift off for a few hours.
Okay. So I don't know how far back you go. When you were about 10, did you have a clock to wake you up? Or I know you grew up on a farm, so were you relying on the rooster?
No.
Okay.
No. Predominantly it was when the sun comes, when it gets light out is when you get out of bed.
Okay.
Or just before.
Okay.
You know, when it starts to get light. But you also went to bed earlier too. as far as that's concerned.
Yeah.
You also had alarm clocks.
So it's interesting.
Wind-up clocks, that is.
Yeah, I have one in my hand, as a matter of fact. I would have to wind it up every night, and I would wake up to the sound of and that nice little ringing there. And that was just how I got up in the morning for a while. And then along the way, that moved to electric, and then eventually digital, and it's evolved over the years. It's interesting how technology has really moved in those years. Before I dive into what I do now, let me ask you, how do you wake up? I mean, you're retired now, so do you just wake up whenever you wake up, or?
More or less.
Do you?
Put it this way, I wake up.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily get up.
Okay. All right.
All right. And usually I'm waking up after about 6 to 8 hours.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. And I'll get up anywhere from the 8 hours to 12 hours after I went to bed. Depends.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But I'm waking up because my body is telling me it's time to wake up.
Okay.
Okay. Not because I got an alarm clock telling me it's time to get up. No.
Well, I have, over the years, had to kind of shift through. And yes, of course, regular alarm clocks for a long time. And then when I moved over into the smartphone realm, I started to use the alarm clock on my smartphone to mm-hmm. to wake me up. I found that that was a nice, reliable way. You didn't have to worry about power. You didn't have to worry about any of that because you're charging the phone. I always would charge the phone next to the bed. And that was for a while, actually. I didn't even do that because I left the smartphone in the other room. I still relied on digital alarm clocks for a while. But I moved to that. And then these days, we've got a couple of different options in my home. We utilize Alexa, and we leave, we say, Alexa, wake me up at 7 a.m. or whatever it is, whatever time we're going to get up. And that's actually my wife's preferred method. In my case, I have... and this is getting into a wild area. When I go to bed, I start this app called Sleep Cycle. And Sleep Cycle is really cool because it monitors my breathing during the night. It knows whether I'm what kind of pattern of sleep I'm in based on how fast I'm breathing. You know, am I taking very long, slow, deep breaths? Am I snoring or whatever else? And it gives me a nice little sleep report, and it gives me a score based off of that. The funny thing is, I know how accurate it is because if I may go to bed and I may sleep through the night and I'm tossing and turning and it goes, yeah, you didn't sleep so well last night. And other times it goes, yeah, you rocked it last night. You were out. You did the right amount of deep sleep and the right amount of light sleep and REM sleep and all of this. And it gives me a good tracking over time, which helps me improve my sleep. That also helps me target getting the right amount of sleep, the right quantity. Although I kind of already had a good handle on it. The nice thing is when it comes time to wake up, it plays a nice little soft, light build on up to an alarm clock. Instead of like that wind up that I had a moment ago where it's just like, and, yeah, you, and you're jarred out of your bed. You're like, ah, what's going on? It just gently wakes you up. I know other people do things like, they will set up their smart light bulbs in their room, or they'll actually have dedicated alarm clocks with lights that start off the process.
With me, when I was growing up, if I had an alarm clock like your wind-up, somehow I would always wake up 4, maybe 5 minutes before the alarm goes off so I can reek over and turn it off.
That
kind of stuff. Today, like I said, I don't really have an alarm clock. I use technology.
Yeah.
Smartphones for telling me what is the time, and it tells me what time it is or what mm-hmm. day it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm getting older. I keep forgetting what day of the week it is.
well, you don't have to go to work.
That's it.
So, yeah, and that is okay. Whatever method we use, and over the years, people have done all kinds of different things to do that. I do enjoy the gentle alarm. I think the light version that people do that kind of mimics the sunrise, but it does it at the same time every day instead of course the sunrise shifts all the time.
Yep.
I think that is an excellent way to go for a lot of people. For me, I I bury my head under the blanket, so the light's not going to do a whole lot of good for me. But that's another story for another day. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. The website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. That is, of course, the way you can check out the podcast, the news items, but also reach out to me with your computer questions and your technology concerns. Whatever they may be, I will get back with you. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me now. And last week, we talked about AI4 and Black Hat, two big conferences simultaneously in Vegas. And, of course, Black Hat is one that I really want to catch that someday. It is just that entire security world. But we talked about the ambiance, the experience overall of just the amazing stuff. You said this week you wanted to really touch on a lot of the takeaways that really hit you after a few days of thinking. So let's dive in.
Yes, absolutely. And the two syndication codes are TBW2216. That's the conference whispers for AI4. And for Black Hat, it's TBW2226. So if you go to TBWAdvisors.com, that's T for technical, B for business, W for whispers, TBWAdvisors.com/the TBW and the 4-digit number code, you'll see the whole publication. And both videos are premiering on our channel. We loaded over 110 videos between the two events.
Yeah. So now that means up on YouTube, you've been feeding all of those up. Are they all posted now?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
I mean, that's
AI4. Yes, it was huge. AI4 was all about AI for adoption, implementation, governance, and business outcomes. Mm-hmm. It was very much about the reality at scale for enterprises, not about the fringe consumer where you go, but can it really house it? This was all about realizing it in the enterprise. And
okay.
So a number of vendors, we had, you know, sometimes they talk about industrializing, scalizing it, the business angle, business methods, a model op, actualized AI, and a value serve were all focused on, you know, platforms and realizing it at that enterprise scale in reality and controlling it. But if you're in a regulated industry and you're the DevSec team, the dev security operations, which is the extra procedures around creating code when you're in those highly regulated industries. This is a very interesting solution by Digital AI. And what I loved about them is they specifically said, we strategically put AI in, focused only on enhancing delivery and planning and speed to market. So it was a classic example, not only of a tool, but how your mission, how you're integrating it should be very focused on the point, the business impact you're trying to achieve.
Okay. Nice.
Amazing. One of the other problems that people have had, and you've heard about it, they roll out agents and, oh, it deleted my code, or ah, it deleted the database.
I haven't heard any of the, oh, wait, we've reported on that a lot. Yes, very common issues.
Rubik gives you rewind capabilities.
Okay, all right.
Including restoration and backups and all of that. One of the other reliability issues is all upon dependencies. And I know you care about reliability,
yes,
tracking things down, yes, when they, yeah, go wrong. And if you don't know the dependencies, your chances of figuring out what went wrong is a wish.
It's a dream, really. Yeah, it's
a delusion.
Yes, yes, indeed.
The ultimate hallucination.
Yeah.
So Lineage with J focuses on dependencies for agents and open source.
Okay.
So, you know, I found a lot of great enterprise tools that when you think about this stuff, but if you ever think about bringing it into your company, an enterprise, I mean, an official business versus your personal consumption.
Sure.
I mean, if you're a business of your husband and or are you and your spouse,
yeah,
or you yourself and you, on the business side, you're still going to want to look at these for how you're using AI in your environment.
Sure.
That's how, sure, how handy these are, which is why I know a lot of people, you know, they think, oh, it's a small business of me. You, yeah, want to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And then ELM used the advice we did in the WISP report where they took their product, which was used for in gaming and chatting and finding what people are talking about, broke it down into an architectural model with each an API for all the different models. So you put, yeah, it together how, yeah, you want.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Now, Black Hat, this was, yes, this is the big, huge conference. This is all about cybersecurity, really.
Yeah.
And it's framed from both directions, which is a very interesting approach. And I like, yeah, that approach.
And I got some of the speakers from the arsenal. So about a website where you go to the wrong website, and from that website, the agent can come and compromise your bank account on your computer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You'll want to hear about that. A free tool for hackers from Securonics called Obscurize, where you can make a sandbox look like a bare metal machine or vice versa.
Oh, wow.
So there are certain things you create in IT to make it think it was where all the good stuff is, but isn't.
Okay.
Like a
honeypot. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Or where you want to play with it to see how it acts, but not where it really can hurt you. Or you want to, distract it. But all the tools you would use for threat hunting, Coggle, the knowledge graph, Securonics does their sand traps, even interviewed some threat hunters, Black Kills, White Hats, very interesting. If you like comics, because I'm thinking a lot of people that like, okay, talk radio like comic books.
Yes.
So Black Hills actually creates the future is Star comic book, and it's available in 750 comic book stores.
Okay.
And they also have a video game called Backdoor and Breaches with over 150,000 copies sold.
Okay, so this is a video game about essentially hacking.
Backdoors, okay, and breaches. You, yeah, learn, okay, about different, yeah, ways that people try to hack you, so you can learn how to threat detect and hunt and prevent.
Yes, I like that. Okay.
Because threat hunting is actually a profession, right?
Yes. Oh, definitely.
You know, there's people who go bounty hunters, you know, in the world at,
sure,
large. Right?
Yes.
There's detectives in the police station go after criminals. Well, in cybersecurity, there's threat hunters.
Yes.
And they study,
yes,
and they learn, given threats in the environment, they try to find new ones and learn everything about it so they can stop it and prevent it. But that's actually a very interesting prevention.
Absolutely fascinating. All of the large corporations that I've worked at, they have had those threat hunters, and the conversations I've had with them have been amazing.
Yeah, admittedly, in my sabbatical, I used to go to the monthly update from the local threat hunters at the con.
Yes, yes.
My favorite thing outside of production live site, you know, is because it's all researched and the details that make the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then finding it through. So, but also ISC West was there, the big organization for cybersecurity
sure.
professionals.
Sure.
So if you want to be in the organization training certification, make sure you find them.
Definitely. Oh, man, all kinds of crazy stuff. But as for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And Dr. Doreen Galley.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. The website ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. I've got two questions here. Jenna asked how she can get her passwords under control, and Marcus asked how he can build a simple system for keeping his digital documents organized. Let's dive into Jenna's, though. A strong way to get your passwords under control is by creating one seed phrase. It can be whatever length you want. It becomes the foundation for all of your passwords. I've been doing this for a long time. And this seed phrase isn't a clever word or a string of symbols. It's a short, memorable item that makes sense to you. And it can be kind of long. And because it's long, it actually becomes harder for attackers to crack this. And because it's personal, you won't forget it. That single phrase becomes an anchor for your entire security system. Once you have a seed phrase, you then adapt it for each different location, every account, by adding in a predictable modifier. It might be the first two letters of the service, the entire service, a number tied to a category, or a tiny pattern that you can repeat without thinking about it. This keeps every password unique without forcing you to memorize dozens of unrelated strings. You're building variations on a theme instead of inventing something new every single time. And that consistency makes the whole system easier to maintain. A seed phrase will also protect you from common mistakes that people make with passwords. You're not relying on pet names or birthdays or familiar patterns that attackers can guess. You're using something long enough to just push back against those brute force attacks and personal enough to stay out of public records. And that combination is powerful. It gives you strength without the complexity that usually comes along with something like whenever we're asked for those long passwords. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want you to abandon things like two-factor authentication. That actually adds in a second wall behind your seed phrase. You should be turning this on every place you can. Therefore, if someone manages to guess or steal one of your modified versions, they still can't get in without the extra two-factor code. And this small step blocks most of those automated attacks. It also gives you peace of mind because you know that your accounts aren't relying on just a single barrier. Security then becomes layers instead of one fragile password. Now, I do suggest as you convert over into that seed phrase philosophy, you start cleaning out your old accounts. You simplify your digital life through just that pruning that you're going to do. Many people have dozens of logins they haven't touched in years, and each one of those becomes a potential attack point, a weak point in your life. Closing the ones you don't use anymore reduces your exposure. It also makes your seed phrase system easier to manage because you're maintaining fewer variations. Fewer accounts means fewer opportunities for trouble, where the bad guys get in and take whatever it is that they want. So once your seed phrase becomes part of a routine, your anxiety is going to fade. You're no longer scrambling to remember which password goes with Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever. You're not resetting accounts every few weeks. You're operating from a place of control. And that control makes every login feel lighter. Now, Marcus, he wanted to know how he can build a simple system for keeping his digital documents organized. One of the best places I tell people to start with is choose a primary storage location. This is the gold location. When your files live in that gold location, all of them, and it doesn't matter if it's on a local hard drive, an external hard drive, a cloud service, whatever it is, you want the golden location. Everything here is the important stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, it's a central hub. It's an anchor for everything else. Everything else from there becomes your backups, your silver and your bronze. This makes all of those backups easier because you're protecting one gold library instead of several of them scattered wherever. Oh, yeah, that's my resume stuff. That's going to be out on Google Drive. Oh, that's my home stuff. That's going to be on OneDrive. That's the book that I'm writing, whatever it is. You know, it's going to be on my local drive. You want a foundation all set together. Okay, so creating in that golden location, you want a small set of broad folders. And you're going to go deeper down through the structure. You want broad folders to really focus in the different things. And that will help keep a structure manageable. Overly detailed categories. If you go to that folder and there's 20 of them, you need to combine them together. You need, if there's 50 of them, you need to really combine them together. All right. When you start doing stuff like that, a bunch of different options, you're going to get lost. So you create one folder for all of your financial information. And underneath that, you create, again, you've tried to narrow that down, banking information, retirement information, and maybe one or two more categories. The whole idea here is built off of something we did a long time ago. It was discovered with websites. If you give people simple menus, five different options, they will gladly choose one of those five, even if that leads to another five and another five and another five, versus giving them 100 options on one screen. So this still applies today. A handful of clear labels gives you room to grow without drowning in that complexity. It makes filing faster because you're not choosing between dozens of options. You are, but it's in those layers. Okay, it goes here, 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 this subfolder, here. It goes right there. You also need to name your files consistently. That will save hours of frustration. Dates, project names, and short descriptions help you find things quickly. You set up whatever it is that you want for your naming pattern, And there was a wide variety of these. But when that naming pattern is steady, search tools actually become far more effective. You're going to spend less time scrolling and more time working. Yes, you have to invest time into this. You are going to have to take some of these efforts. And that means you're going to set aside a little bit of time each week, a weekly cleanup session that prevents clutter from returning. Digital mess just grows silently. And all of these different little cleaning sessions help control all of this. They don't need to be long. 10 minutes a week can make a difference. And that'll help you catch duplicates, outdated drafts, straight downloads, all of the rest of that. It's okay. Make sure you're backing it up. You need to have a gold, a silver, and a bronze location. Maybe even multiple silvers, multiple bronze locations. So you can go to those other locations in a pinch and get all of your information. It's just basic backups. Both of these questions really point to a very similar story here. Your digital world needs to be managed. And it becomes manageable when you build one clearly defined foundation and then build habits upon that. Yes, that's the cleanup habits, the recurring, I'm following this pattern, I'm going in this direction. That's okay. This is the way to manage all of that. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how it all intertwines. One of the things I've noticed over the years is that many organizations don't notice digital inefficiency until it becomes impossible to ignore. And this digital inefficiency, I've seen this time and time again. It doesn't show up as like a single outage or some kind of dramatic failure. It shows up as 1,000 tiny delays that quietly drain momentum from the workday. Now, these delays hide in plain sight. An app might take an extra moment to launch here and there, or there might be a confusing interface, or there's a file that takes too long to find, or you name it. There's all of these different things that set us back in the middle of the day. Small, little, I lost 5 seconds, 10 seconds there, and we blow it off because it doesn't feel like a crisis. But across a team, across a division, across an entire enterprise, all of these different small, little 5 to 10 second delays add up to many man hours of lost focus. You know, we can see this when someone waits for a spreadsheet to load, or they click through a whole series of different folders to try to find a document that should have been in an obvious file structure, or whatever it is. The work will get done, but this takes more energy than it should. Even communication tools contribute to this. There are messages that they get buried or lost, and there are notifications that arrive late. And one of my pain points that I experienced a while back was a thread that splintered into multiple different threads, channels, if you will, which forced me to cross all kinds of different things, retracing steps. Did I tell these folks this? Did I tell these folks the same? No, I said something different. And I had to piece that all apart. Even though everybody should have been in the same room, it was like having five different conversations in five different conference rooms and nobody understood what was going on. Inefficiency doesn't shout. It whispers constantly. In many workplaces, the biggest cost isn't the delay itself. It's going to be that mental reset that's associated with whatever follows. Every interruption forces people to retrain their thought processes. And that little bit of cognitive tax is far heavier than the seconds on the clock. We see this in meetings. You know, when someone spends 5 minutes hunting for the right slide or the latest version of a report, the entire room just loses momentum and interest, and people start falling asleep, and the energy just drops like a lead balloon. And we have systems contributing their own friction to this. We've got outdated tools and inconsistent workflows. And, you know, I know someone right now, I've been telling them to go and tell their tech department that their 7-year-old laptop needs replacing real soon. And we see this all the way around. These different things create landscapes where every task, every kind of thing that's going on around the workplace may need a workaround, and people adapt. But that adaptation becomes a burden, not on the technology, it becomes a burden on the user. And when you spread all of these small inefficiencies around across an organization, an enterprise, that actually shapes the culture. That inefficiency shapes the culture. I want you to understand this, because work feels harder than it should, and projects feel slower than they need to be, and the drag just becomes accepted. It feels normal. The real cost isn't time, although it is a cost. It's the erosion of focus and morale. Organizations that address digital inefficiency don't start with technology. They start by watching how people work. The bottlenecks will reveal themselves in the moments where someone sighs, or they hesitate, or they just go through a step that they shouldn't have to repeat. You got the idea. Once we start seeing these patterns, the fixes become clear. We can simplify our workflow. We can streamline tools and reduce clutter. And the whole goal here is to remove the friction points that interrupt the workday. Even small improvements can make a notable difference. A cleaner shared drive, a faster login, a cleaner interface. Each of these gives people a little bit more room to think and a little bit more confidence in their tools. When the digital environment supports the pace of the work instead of slowing it down, all of us, every one of us, can start to feel a kind of quiet ease. Along with that, the organization will feel lighter and more coordinated. And as a result, you feel more capable. This is a big thing. Inefficiency is killing speed. We need to be removing the drag that keeps people from doing their best work. And when companies treat digital inefficiency as a real business cost, not just an annoyance, they unlock productivity that they didn't realize that they were losing. The work becomes smoother, the days feel shorter, the entire organization benefits from the clarity that follows. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
You
years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Victor reached out with a question. My home mesh Wi-Fi keeps moving devices between the nodes even when the signal seems fine. Why does it reshuffle everything? And this is something that has to do with how mesh Wi-Fi systems work. They don't look just at single items. They look at things like an overall network health, not just signal strength. We think of it as just it goes to the strongest point. But if one of the nodes in your mesh gets busy or it has too many devices on it, the system starts shifting things around to keep everything balanced. It's trying to prevent these slowdowns before you notice them. And these mesh systems, they're great. They're updating things regularly. And to do those updates, they're also going to test connection quality between the different nodes. If one path becomes slightly less efficient, even for a short period of time, even a moment, the system may say, okay, I'm going to move this device over to a different node. It's reacting to tiny changes you'd never see. Devices themselves will actually influence all of this reshuffling. Phones, laptops, and smart gadgets often choose the node that they think best, but then they make odd choices in that. The mesh system will try to correct these choices on the fly. We also have issues like background interference. You've got a microwave. It's a neighbor's router or a Bluetooth device can actually even throw the system into reorganizing the network, all to keep things smooth and running nice and calm. All of this reshuffling, it isn't chaos. It is part of how the mesh system is designed to constantly tune itself to stay ahead of any problems that you might experience. If the reshuffling isn't causing slowdowns, it's mostly harmless. Mesh networkers, they're designed to be dynamic. They're not designed to stay the same all the time. All of this movement is how they stay stable. If the switching becomes annoying or causes brief drops, you can adjust the placement of your nodes. And I've done this a little bit. I've tweaked some of the locations in my own home. And moving them just from one power outlet over to another, a few feet in either direction, can actually make the system settle down into a more predictable pattern. Some of these mesh systems also will allow you to set preferred nodes or limit how aggressively these devices roam. Turning those features on can also give you a calmer, more predictable network, which is, it sounds like that's what your goal is here. If a single device keeps bouncing around, restarting it can also reset its own internal Wi-Fi logic. Look, think of the mesh system as the air traffic controller. It is always pushing all of these different things in the, what you might consider, the air to keep the flow smooth, even when the skies look clear. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.